Thank you. Good morning. Our learning this morning is sponsored by Herman and Sima Hertzberg, in memory of Herman's father, Larry Hertzberg, Aryeh Lev Ben Shalom, Aleva Shalom, and also by Jerry and Chani Zatz, in memory of Chani's father, Rav Shmuel Schmidman, Rav Shmuel Ben Rav Michal, Aleva Shalom, and Shemot Havaliyot. Our learning is in their memory. May their memory continue to have a blessing. So let us turn to Daf Yud Aleph today. We're starting at the beginning of a Daf, and please God, we'll end right at the very end. There's no period that is put in. I think I stick that in myself. Maybe there is. Is there a period at the end of Yud Aleph Hamabet? I can't tell if that was me. Okay, so that was me. But that'll be a comfortable stopping place for us, and we will, please God, get there smoothly. We are going to do the 7th and 8th Mishnah of the second Perek, and this is the penultimate full Daf. So we've got one more full Daf after this, of the second Perek, and then we shift into the third and final chapter of Masechet Makot, which is, funnily enough, Elu Hein Alokin, the people who get lashes. Malchus, we're finally going to talk about Malchus. Not that we're excited to talk about whipping and lashing people, but we are anticipating the central topic that gives this tractate its title. Again, the first chapter was about Im Zomimim scheming, the inability to execute justice smoothly. This second chapter seems to be about how to remedy the inability to distribute justice equitably in making sure that society is as attentive as possible to each other. That, again, every time something comes up in the news, it kind of makes me think about it. Last week, maybe it was this week, Alec Baldwin's case, was he charged this week or last week?
Last week.
And in one of the news segments that was talking about it, they had a lot of questions being posed, like, if you admit, bless you, if you admit that this was not intentional, how can you charge him? You know, how can you call it a crime if you admit that he didn't want to kill them? And the prosecutor had to spend a lot of time explaining that negligence can be criminal, and for some reason didn't reference our case, and Masechet Makot, but of course, it's not that the intent was the crime, it was the lack of intent that was the crime, and you can be charged for that, and it feels unjust. How can you punish them? Send them to jail when they didn't mean to do it? And of course, what we see over the last few Dapim is if you don't intend something, but it was criminal lack of intention, you get sent away to exile. Now, what we did on the last Daf, the first five Mishnayos were about characterizing what is too unintentional. Meaning there is such a thing as an accident where it wasn't negligence, accidents happen. And that's what's going to be Alec Baldwin's defense, presumably, that it wasn't unintentional, it was completely accidental. I did as much as I should have been liable to do to make sure that nothing was going to happen, and things happen, and it wasn't my fault. So that was the first five Mishnayos, and the last Mishnah was about describing what Ari Miklat look like. What do these cities of refuge look like? What is their aim? Is it just like a deep, dark pit that we throw these negligent people into, or is it about rehabilitating them? And we've suggested that if there is a obligation on the part of society to provide them with food, marketplaces, peers, population, friends, neighbors, elders, leaders, teachers. So it clearly has some sort of rehabilitative quality, and it's not intended to just be punitive entirely. And what we're going to shift in today with the two Mishnayos is how long is the sentence? There are seemingly arbitrary sentences set. I think when they were talking about Alec Baldwin, they said the potential years for negligent manslaughter is like 8 to 10. Who decided 8 to 10? Maybe this person's unintentional would take 10 months to remedy, maybe take forever. So we're going to see a different length set in the first Mishnah we cover, and then as we turn on to the next page, there'll be questions about how flexible is this incarceration. What happens if... who would you say is the most skilled person in technology in the United States today? By popular stereotype.
Elon Musk.
So let's say Elon Musk is caught for some horrific crime and is sentenced to jail. And then we go to cyber war with Russia, and the government thinks, you know what we could really do with his help? Maybe we should let him out. There's a movie, actually, where this happens, where there's somebody, where is it? Somebody who's arrested by the FBI, and then they need his help, so they let him out on condition they help the government. Catch Me If You Can, that happens right at the end. Anyone seen Catch Me If You Can? So that happens right at the end, where he's like the best fraudster in the world, and they say, we'll let you out of jail if you help us catch the rest of the fraudsters, and he comes out. I think he actually went on a speaking tour. What was his name? Oh, that was the actor. I can't remember, Frank something or another. My father-in-law heard him speak somewhere at a conference about what he did. Abagnale, there you go. So the question is, if you get sent to exile, are you allowed out? And the mission is going to say, even if you are the most skilled military general in Israel, you are not allowed out to help in wartime. You're stuck there. And the question seems to be like, why would we hamstring the people to help this person become rehabilitated? So we'll get to that. So let's start at the top of Yud Aleph, Ahmed Aleph. I actually, any of you have an in-person Gemara? Okay, because it starts about a line or half a line before where we've got here. It's all right, I'll find it on my phone. Anyone know which Masechta we're doing? Yeah, there we go. We'll get there eventually. Okay. So the first question, this is finishing off reflections from last time, which was describing what the purpose of Imekat is. So the first, I'll just say it out. So Amr B'chama B'rachanina, Rav Chama B'chanina, Mipnei Man Nemar Parshat Rotzchem, why when it talks about murderers does it say, and now on the top of our daf, B'loshan Aza, why does it speak in a very harsh way in the book of Joshua when Joshua is told to write about Imekat? So this is right at the end of the book of Joshua. Anyone read Joshua cover to cover? Few people have. There about seven chapters in the middle are known as kind of the boring chapters, where it literally is just talking about geography. This tribe gets this, this tribe gets that. The first like 11 chapters are incredibly dramatic. They go to Jericho, they find Rahab, the walls fall down, they get killed at Ai. They slaughter 31 Canaanite kings, the sun stops in the sky, they hang a bunch of people, they have a mass circumcision, they cross the river stops. And then it's like seven chapters of, and they got this piece of land, and they got this piece of land, and it used to be called Cunningham Park, and now it's called Hollis Hills, and now it's called Hollis. Okay, okay. And then the last three chapters, there's a big gathering. When Joshua recounts Israelite history, there's a lot of controversy about the fact that when he goes through Jewish history, he skips a massively important event. He talks about the Exodus from Egypt, he talks about going through the Midbar, and there's something he doesn't talk about, which you think would be the key moment of Jewish history. He doesn't talk about Har Sinai. And the question is, why doesn't he refer to that in this moment? And of course, there are commentaries on that. But then right at the end, it says, and also, Joshua, while you're dividing up this land, remember to designate these final three Ir Miklat. Because Moshe set aside the three on the east of the Jordan. You have to set aside the three on the west of the Jordan. Make sure it's done. And it is the only time in the 24 chapters of Joshua where it says, Vayedaber Hashem, not Vayoma Hashem, that God spoke rather than said. So Rav China asks, why is it only in the context of Miklat that God speaks in such a harsh way? Dichtiv, as it says, Vaydaber Hashem el Yehoshua le'emor, God spoke harshly to Joshua, saying, Daber al b'nei Israel le'emor, speak to the Jews and say, Tenu lachem, edari miklat asher dibarti alechem, and the word diber appears three times. This seems to be high up on God's priority, setting aside these cities. Answer the Gemara gives, Mipnei Shehen Shel Torah, because they are of the Torah. What does that mean? Good question. Some suggest it's the only Do'oraita material that comes up. Some suggest that's impossible, because in the fifth chapter, Joshua conducts a mass circumcision, which is a biblical matter, and he's told to do that by God. That's a biblical issue. And there are different ways of reading this. One way to read it is Mipnei Shehen Shel Torah, meaning this is rehabilitative for society. You're about to found the first autonomous political entity in Jewish history. So far we've had Jewish families, we've had Jewish tribal reality, we've lived in the desert under God's protection, but now you're setting up a government for the first time. If you don't, it's like not setting up a prison system, which you might think is an afterthought disciplinary measure, but this is Shel Torah. If you don't set this up, society will fall apart, and you need citizens to be responsible. So the Gemara responds just incidentally, you're saying every time the word diber appears, it's kind of a harsh terminology. In. Yes. Thank you, John. Yes, says John and the Gemara. Kedichtiv, as it says, this is how the brothers respond to Jacob when they come back from Joseph in Egypt. They don't know it's Joseph. They've just met the viceroy. And they come to Yaakov and they say, Diber ha'ish adnei ha'aretz itanu kashot. The man who was in charge of the land spoke with us harshly. Diber. So it sounds like it is a harsh term. Vahatanya, but there's another writer that quotes from the Psalms and Malachi, Nidbaru, where it says Nidbaru, talking about leadership, a Nidbaru Eloshe Nachat, and the Brayta said Nidbaru is a calm terminology, V'cheinu Omer, and further in elsewhere, it says Yadber Amim Tachtenu, envisioning the future, that the nations of the world will be led or persuaded under us. And here it sounds like it's gentle. So the Gemara finishes, Diber Lechud, Yadber Lechud. There is a huge difference between the word Diber and Yadber. And you might think, okay, this is just rabbinic pedantry. Why are we wrapping up the this section of the Gemara this way? And it's to some degree we could rescue this apparently grammatical ending by suggesting that a tiny inflection in a root can make a huge difference. And again, through the prism of sending somebody off to exile, we are capable of massive change, and to think that this is in essence who you are, you're a negligent person, you're always going to make accidents, we can't improve you, just get out into a deep dark pit. Actually make a tiny inflection in a root and it can mean a massively different thing. What the word that appears deeply harsh and acerbic can be shifted into a gentle persuasion with a small touch. And if we send you into exile, perhaps there's a possibility of reshaping your character. It's a little homiletic, but why not? Okay, let's finish off.
Are you saying something other than just this, you know, the seven binyanim, or is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are suggestions it's actually not the same word. It just shares a root, but Yadver means lead rather than speak, and it just happens to share the root. But yeah, that's what I was going for. We now have three debates between Rabbi Yehuda and a peer, which begins on the subject of Irmiklat and then seems to go astray into other areas where they debate. Pligi Rabbi Yehuda Rabbanan, Rabbi Yehuda Rabbanan had a debate. Chad Omer b'nei Shishiyem, Chad Omer b'nei Shen Torah. On the subject, why was God harsh about Irmiklat? One of them, the rabbi, seemed to agree that we stated that because it's a central facet of social life. That's why God spoke harshly. But there's another Rabbi Yehuda, it seems, took the view. The reason God spoke harshly was Joshua delayed. Joshua wasn't getting on with setting aside these Irmiklat. And to some degree, it's the same idea we've noted, that he thought it's an afterthought, setting up jails. You know, that we'll get to that when someone commits a crime. But right now, we're trying to set up society. Nobody's going to commit a crime. And it seems to be the implication is there will always be crime in society until the end of days. And we need to set up jails from the start. So people should know it's not just a after-the-fact response to crime. It is part of society functioning that people know that there is justice, that there will be repercussions. It's deterrent, exactly. So, next argument in the green. And Joshua wrote these words in the Torah of God. What words did Joshua write in the Torah? Didn't Moshe write the whole Torah? Did Joshua write any of the Torah? Whatever, focus on the whatever. There you go, eight. So you got the whatever was the extra passage. Okay. So one view is, oh, it's talking about the last eight psukim. There's another who says, no, Moshe wrote the whole Torah. There's something else that Joshua wrote of biblical proportions, which is our subject, Irmiklat. Pligi bar Yehuda Rav Nechemya. Rechemya Rav Yehuda disagreed. Chadam Rishman psukim. One said it's talking about the last eight verses that Joshua wrote. Chadam Irmiklat. One said, no, it's talking about Irmiklat that Joshua wrote. It makes perfect sense if you're talking about eight psukim. That's why it says he wrote it in the Torah of God. The person who says it's talking about Irmiklat, why does it say he wrote it in the Torah of God? Moshe wrote that. He didn't write that. Hachikama, this is how it should be read. Joshua wrote in his book the same matters that were already repeated in the biblical text itself, in the Mosaic books. Full stop. Third argument. Sefer Shetafra B'Pishtan. If you have a Sefer Torah that was sewed with cotton thread, Sefer Torah is written on parchment. What kind of parchment is Sefer Torah written on? Has to be a kosher animal. Has to be leather and has to be a kosher animal. Does it have to be written on the inside of the skin or the outside of the skin? Outside. Correct. One of them. I'm blanking right now. I'm pretty sure it's the inside. Did you say outside? Maybe you're right. Maybe it's the outside. It's one or the other. Yes, as Michael said. And it has to be sewed together with animal sinews. It has to be entirely crafted from animate matter. Well, ex-animate matter, it seems. But there is a debate. What if it was sewed together with cotton? Chadam ha-kosher v'chadam ha-pasal. One said it's kosher, one said it's not kosher with cotton. Why? What are they arguing about? The mandam ha-pasal, the person who says that it's invalid, because when it's talking about tefillin, it says, The reason you wear tefillin, this was in the parasha we just read over Shabbos, why do you wear tefillin? So that the Torah of God should be beficha, in your mouth. So in that, where it says Torah, it compares tefillin to the rest of Torah, meaning the Sefer Torah. So all the laws that apply to tefillin apply to a Sefer Torah. And a tefillin has to be written on kosher parchment. How do I know? Because it says beficha, just as something that can go into your mouth. That's what has to be the source material for the tefillin. And it has to be sewed with sinews, or laws, halachah mishmisinai with tefillin. So it seems to be, you compare that to the rest. And the Sefer Torah as well. Ma tefillin lach l'mishu misin l'tov from beginning, just with tefillin, has to be sewed with sinews of kol l'tov from beginning. So to every sacred scripture has to be written and sewed with sinews. That's one view. V'idach, the other view, ki itkish l'mot b'ficha, you only compare it to the material it's written on, that which is kosher to eat, l'hilchotav, lo itkish, but all the accompanying laws of tefillin don't get transferred across to Sefer Torah, full stop. Amar Rav, Rav said, chazin l'u tefillin d'bei chavivi, I saw the tefillin of my uncle, who Rashi points out, was Reb Chia, the Tfiri Bechitna, and it was sewed with cotton, but it doesn't follow those rules.
Wax.
Linen isn't cotton?
No.
Okay, there you go. One or the other. They're not similar? But they're plants. Plants. They're plants. I'm just, as long as it's not wool. There's wool and then there's fiber. So linen, cotton, yeah. I don't know. Yes, the right now I think cotton is kind of fluffy when it grows. Linen, I think, grows as fibrous threads, but I've not been involved in agriculture for a while. Okay. Either way, it seems that Rav's uncle used to wear these cotton-sewed tefillin, but we don't follow that. So it seems to be there are different practices around tefillin, and we can spend a lot of time talking about tefillin on a kind of second basis rabbit hole. My father says that they've just got a new rabbi in my father's shul, and he started a crusade going around Minyan every morning, making sure everybody's tefillin is in exactly the right spot, which is right up here above the hairline, or as one of my teachers in high school used to say, where the hairline used to be, which I used to think, ha ha ha. Yes, and my father said, and my father usually wears his tefillin under his chin or something. So he said that every day the rabbi comes along, and he actually pushed it up on my father's head, made a whole thing out of it. And then my father was speaking to my brother-in-law, who was reading some biography from Rav Cook, who spent 2 years in London when he got caught there after the First World War. And there was a story about Rav Cook giving a whole speech about tefillin needing to be in the right place. And my father mentioned this story to the new rabbi, and he said, see, I told you that it has to be in the right place. And he says, no, I'm telling you, it seems to be British minhag to wear it down here, because Rav Cook had to talk about it 60 years ago, so that didn't go well. Anyway, so there are debates around how tefillin should be made, be worn, not that much of a debate anymore. Later, Hilchotukvate, we don't follow that view. Full stop, end of meditation on that sixth Mishnah about rehabilitative purposes of miklat. Onto the length of the sentence. We've said 8 to 10 sometimes is applied for manslaughter, 20 to life. The police who were just charged on Friday, I think all of them, the charges come with 20 to life, the second degree murder. I might be wrong about that. But these, who decides on the length of time? Now, of course, intentional murder in Jewish law comes with a very straightforward sentence, which is execution. Although we finished the first chapter with Rabbi Akiva saying, if I were in charge, no one would ever be executed, which of course raised alarm bells for the other sages. Says, so you just let murderers wander around and get them off the hook. And in Sanhedrin, it talks about, is there a rabbinic system to deal with crimes other than just plain execution? But we're talking about accidents at the moment. So, seventh mission of the Perek. Echad, Meshoch, B'Shem, Mishcha. Kohen Gadol can become a Kohen Gadol. How do you become president of the United States? There's only one way. Well, you get elected, but that doesn't actually make you president. That makes you president-elect. How do you become president legally? So that you've got authority.
If you're vice president, the president dies.
You have to take an oath of office. I might be mistaken, but if the president dies and you haven't taken an oath of office, I don't think you've got the authority yet. So the oath of office is what makes you the president or any officer in the United States government. If you don't take the oath, you're not in. So to become a Kohen Gadol, it can't just be the previous one has to die. You have to have certain rituals take place. And there are a couple of options. One is to get anointed with oil. The Meshoach, B'Shem, and HaMishcha, that would make you the Kohen Gadol. If they, at some point, they lost the oil, they couldn't find it anymore, so how do you become a Kohen Gadol? The alternative was Merubah Begadim, which was to put on the extra vestments the Kohen Gadol would wear. How do you become Pope? Practice. How do you become Pope? Is it the election that does it? Do you have to have then a prayer or anointment or something? Yeah, you retired, obviously. I mean, it's interesting because King Charles right now is king, but his coronation has been set for June. So it's obviously not the coronation that makes you king. That's just a waste of time. I mean, that's just a celebration publicly. But he did have to... He took an oath. Also, he took an oath immediately to become king that I think officially made him king. So the bottom line... It's good to be the king, thank you, Mel. So the bottom line rule is, if the Kohen Gadol dies, everyone in your mikvah goes home. Not everyone, all the people who were sentenced there for exile go home. So which kind of Kohen Gadol are we talking about? Is this only in the old days when there were kind of the oil-made Kohen Gadol or even the Merubah Begadim? So Echad Meshach B'Shem HaMishcha, whether the Kohen Gadol was anointed through oil, Echad Merubah Begadim, or whether they were increased through clothing, that's how they got in. Ve'echad sha'ava mishichato, or talking about recent popes, if lahavdil, if there was a Kohen Gadol who retired from their duty, meaning there was an ex Kohen Gadol who passed away, machzir netaratzeach, all the exiled murderers go home. How could you possibly have a Kohen Gadol who retired? I thought it was for life. That's what they all said until Pope Benedict retired. Can a Kohen Gadol retire? So the answer is not really.
He can be removed from office, right? If he does.
So if you're removed for improper purposes, we'll get to that. But what about retirement? And I'm quote the West Wing.
What if he's sick or, you know?
Right. So this would be on Yom Kippur. There's only one day when only the Kohen Gadol can do a certain avodah. There are lots of things the Kohen Gadol can do, but there can always be a substitute with one exception. Yom Kippur, it has to be the Kohen Gadol who does the avodah of the Kohen Gadol. What happens if he's sick? Or what happens if he has impurity for whatever reason, he has a seminal emission, or he touches a dead body, or something happens. So there's a guy on call who's like the backup Kohen Gadol, and he becomes a Kohen Gadol for the day. So this happens, Lahavdil, hopefully it's just a helpful illustration. In the United States, the president can sign the 25th Amendment, which puts somebody else in power temporarily until it's rescinded. And this happens often when a president has surgery or an operation, they sign somebody else to authority and then it removes. So officially, do those people who serve for that period of time, do they count as a president of the United States? I don't know what the nafgumen is. I think there may be a legal obligation for Congress to pay for a portrait for every president. So that may be the only nafgumen that if you've served as a president, do you need to have a presidential portrait? So if you served for like 20 minutes while the president was out, are you officially, were you president? And that makes the current president, see, 46 now? I know he's like 85, but I mean, is he president 46? So meaning if he signed the 25th Amendment, would there have been a 47th president for 10 minutes? But here, if you had a Kohen Gadol for one day, and then the other Kohen Gadol got pure or better, so he's back on the job, and then he said, okay, I spent the rest of my life, I was Kohen Gadol for 10 minutes, and that was my high point. When did they pass away 30 years later? Was that a Kohen Gadol who died? And the view taken here is, yes, if he passes away, doesn't matter whether he was a serving Kohen Gadol, but that's the end of the sentence for all the exiles. Meaning last month, Lahavdil, when Pope Benedict passed away, he was not the serving pope. But if there was any consequences to a pope dying in Christian thought, which I'm not sure that there are, that would come into effect, even though the current pope was still serving. So Lahavdil, if the Kohen Gadol is still on the job, but an ex-Kohen Gadol dies, all the exiles go free. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, and Rabbi Yehuda says, Af Meshoach Milchama Masiyat Haratzek, says, even if it's the Kohen Gadol, who's not quite the high priest, but serves a function that nobody else serves among the priesthood, which is the priest to inspire the troops. Anyone seen Braveheart, when he walks up and down giving a speech, you can go home and spend the rest of your life, but as you lie on your bed, you will reflect on all the days from this to that and regret that you didn't have freedom. And then the Irish come and kill all the English people. So that is kind of a key part of war, to have somebody to inspire the troops. Who would do that? There would be a certain priest who was designated and anointed for that purpose, who had rhetorical skills, charisma, passion, and would rally the troops. And if that person passed away, it also ended the sentence for all the exiles. That's Rabbi Yehuda's view, but not the mainstream view of the Mishnah. Full stop, second half of the Mishnah. Again, we've just said, what ends the sentence for all these exiled killers? The death of the high priest. So what is every exiled killer whose family is living miles away praying for? The death of the high priest. Lefikach, therefore, imotein shel kohanim, it was the mothers of the priest, that would provide all the food and needs for these cities, so they wouldn't all pray that the high priest dies, because they would think, you know what? His mom's pretty good to us. She makes soup every week. She brings us blankets. You know, I don't want him to die because it's actually quite cushy here. Which is an interesting suggestion, because what does this imply? That a bunch of killers praying might work, right? Meaning you're a bunch of unintentional, negligent killers. This is Alec Baldwin praying for the Pope to die so he can go free. Lahavdil, he's allegedly, I should say. Why would God say, look, there's a lot of people praying. I know they're all horrible and this is the high priest, but there's a lot of them. So really, I should just kill the high priest. It seems like prayer is almost a form of bribe. How does this work? So that's what the Gemara is going to reflect on. All this yellow that goes over the page is a reflection on that question. How can prayer work when it's unjust? How can that possibly be the case?
What is the Havamina of the Mishnah? Why would you even think that it's not the Begadim or Mashiach? What's the question there? Is it obvious that no matter whether you became Kohen Gadol from being anointed or from putting on the Begadim, that would count?
Well, play devil's advocate. Why would you say the opposite? Why would you say it's only one? Why might you say it's only if you're anointed by oil?
That's what I'm saying.
I know, and I'm saying, answer your own question. Play devil's advocate. Push back.
I can't imagine why. They're both legitimate ways that they became Kohen Gadol.
Okay.
I can begin to see the second tier, where the person who had been Kohen Gadol maybe for a day. That I could understand.
Uh-huh.
But this situation, they're both legitimately Kohen Gadol, right?
They are both legitimate, but the anointing oil is seen as the best way in, and the Merubah Begadim is kind of like, if you don't have oil, you can use this. But you might think the whole system's fallen apart.
Wow.
And it's only if you've got oil, and otherwise, so if you don't have a Kohen Gadol, what happens? Like you say, like, what's the alternative? And what is the alternative? If the Kohen Gadol with Merubah Begadim isn't going to be the guy who gets you out, what happens to you if you get sent to Ir Mikla? You're there forever. And at this point, the Gemara is now intimating towards that possibility, which will be the subject of the next Mishnah, which is, are there people who never, ever get out? Well, we'll talk about that there's a cemetery set up for people who never get out. That's where they're buried. That's where they forever. Gemara in the orange. Menahane Mili, where do you get this from, that it's all three of the Kohane Gedolim, if they die, you go free? Amr of Gana, Rav Gana says, Damakra, the Pazik says, the Yeshabad Mot Kohane Gadol, Chetiv Bekimin Eklato Yeshavid Ab Mot Kohane Gadol. It says twice already that you're there until the death of the Kohane Gadol. Chetiv, and a third time, Achrei Mot Kohane Gadol. And the third time it says, you're there until the Kohane Gadol dies. So why does it say it three times? Presumably for each kind of Kohane Gadol. Rabbi Yehuda, and what about Rabbi Yehuda, who says, what about Mashoch Melchama? There's one more verse that talks about the priest, Lashuv Lesherit Ba'arez Admot HaKohen, you're there until the Kohen dies. So there must be a fourth kind of Kohen that you go free if they die, which is Meshuch Melchama. V'idach, what about the rabbis who say that Meshuch Melchama doesn't go free? Midlo Ketiv HaGadol, it doesn't say Kohen Gadol, it says Kohen Chad Mahanachu, so it's talking about one of the other three. Full stop. So there's biblical proof text for whether you go free when the high priest dies only, however they became into office, or whether it's even the person in charge of war. And of course, the question is this purely arbitrary? Why would this be a way to end the sentence in exile? Why should the high priest dying have any impact or connection to people who killed unintentionally? And we're going to try to elicit some of that in a moment. We said that's why, and if you were just reading this mission and think about where would you put the emphasis in interpretation, you would think this is kind of an afterthought about, it's kind of almost humorous. The mothers of the high priest would deliver packages. The center of this mission is talking about when does the sentence end. But the Gemara is, again, not just a legal text, it's also a philosophical text saying, I don't understand what you're suggesting, even if it's in humor. You're saying that the high priest's mother would provide to them as if their prayers would have an impact. Tama says this first yellow, about 15 lines up, first one on his shell. Tama de lo matzlu. You're telling me the only reason the Kohen Gadol doesn't die is because lo matzlu, because his mother convinces them not to pray. Ha matzlu, but if they all got together and they had prayer festivals trying to get rid of the high priest life, mighty, he would die. I don't understand that. Vakativ, surely it says in a verse, Kitzipor lanud kidror la'of, just like a bird flying or a swallow floating away, ken kilat chinam lo tavo, so to a curse of the wise will, kilat chinam, an empty curse won't come to be. Meaning, if some horrible person stands up and say, I curse you, what is this? We're not magical people. You know, if you're a righteous person and you've gotten in with God, maybe you could have some impact. And if it's just like you've done something horrible, maybe God will punish you. But somebody just saying, boo, that's not going to do anything for me. So why would a whole city of accidental murderers praying for the death of the high priest have any impact? I don't understand. Hahus Saba Mepirkei the Rabbi Shamali. So the Gemara responds and says, well, actually, I heard this from some elder in the days of Rava. Shahaya lahen levakesh rachamim al darem lo bakshu. So there is actually some responsibility for which the high priest is liable. You're a high priest. What are you liable for?
Education, not teaching them the right thing.
That's what you would think, right? Meaning the way it's expressed here is Hayah lahen levakesh rachamim. He should have prayed for mercy for these people, which is to some degree what Jerry's saying. Meaning, in some faiths, the priesthood and clerisy is almost an ivory tower where you sit and you study quietly and you don't think about the people, and actually better if you'd have nothing to do with the people. And it's possible to see the Jewish model in that way. They're not meant to come in touch with death. I mean, we often don't think about this very much. The rabbis of today basically serve the role the priests used to serve. They're the teachers, the instructors, they serve pastoral services, they conduct rituals in many ways. But if you were to ask, like, an average community, what is the main thing we need rabbis to be on call for? You know, a drasha, half of us are going to sleep, the rest of us will be fine. If it's not great, it's fine. But there's one thing we need you for: funerals. The priests could never be involved with funerals. They were the public pastors of the people, and they could never, ever be. If you'll make you wonder, so who conducted the funerals back in the days? Families used to do it themselves, and then they would go to the temple to get purified, and the priest would kind of console them through that healing process. But they would have nothing to do with burials, which, of course, occasionally does happen in the modern rabbinate, where you have kohanim, as per the Young Shul of Hotsford, where you have a priest, a kohen. There's also a rabbi who can't be involved in the funeral itself. But so you could see the priesthood as kind of segregated from people. And what the Gemara is emphasizing is that's not how the priesthood works. It's true that the Kohanim are not involved with death itself, but they are meant to be involved in life. They're meant to be there for the people through and through. And the fact that these unintentional murders happen tell you that the priest was not involved with shaping the culture enough. They had walked away. They'd said, what will be, I'm responsible for my Dalai Lama, so I'm going to make sure the Korbanos go well. But society, that can figure itself out. So the Gemara is intimating that actually there would have been an opening. Heaven would be open to these prayers that the high priest should die, because they're all saying, look, society, the fact that we, if it was an accident, that's one thing. But our unintentionality, our negligence is a product of a negligent culture. And that means the people in charge of producing an attentive culture failed. And this high priest isn't doing his job. It's astounding to say that somebody in public office is not shaping the culture enough. Now, of course, the high priest, who would you say is in charge of culture? Who's in charge of the United States right now? Who's the most powerful person? Yeah, you say the president. So who in the Jewish context, parallel, would you say is the most powerful person?
Machlokes.
I would imagine it's the king. Right? Meaning, if you're talking about executive power, and that's not, and this is something that we'll get to in Rabbi Sachs' thought Shabbos afternoon in a few weeks when we talk about his politics, the most powerful people in society are not the people with the hands on the levers of political power. They can do the most damage or the most harm most quickly. But the people who shape society are not public officials with power. It is people with cultural influence. So who has cultural influence in America today?
TikTok,
celebrities, whatever it is. And Rabbi Sachs's major contention we'll come to is that faith leaders are the most powerful people in the West right now. People who go to church or mosque or synagogue or temple, hear messages every week from people who will shape their culture, and they will turn to them as leaders who communicate the legacy of their faith. And they have the power to bring the West to its knees. And President Biden or President Trump or President Obama or Bush can sit there with a red button on their desk and they can wreak horrific damage. But they have very little power to shape what people think in the pews around the country. And that's far more power than the ability to send armies. And this is what seems to emerge out of here. The high priest, who doesn't control the armies, who can't declare war, who doesn't go on conquest, you're responsible for negligence in society because you as a religious leader have the responsibility to shape culture. And you're responsible for all these deaths. So therefore, that's why the Muslims would have to come in and kind of apologize for their son's lack of attentiveness to the culture. That's a kind of opening salvo of this. Vigadamatni, this is the third line in the dark yellow. Some teach it slightly differently. They wouldn't ask them not to pray for him to die, but Kadeshit Palu Abneim Shalo Yamuta, that they should pray that her son shouldn't die. Because really, default is he deserves to die. This is a different way to read the Mishnah, that maybe she thinks he's going to die because of what he did, but I'm going to ask them to pray for him to be saved for mercy, which is obviously a much harsher reading of his responsibility. Tamad Amatso Halamatsumati. So the Gemara says, hold on, you're saying only if they pray he won't die, but if they don't pray, he's going to die. Mahavale Namavad, what should he have done? Hacha Amrinan. This is what we say. And he's now got a couple of paraphrases. Tuvia, the first word in the line is Tuvia. Tuvia chata vezigud mangit. So this comes up in Sanhedrin, where somebody witnessed a murder, but only one witness saw the murder. So he thinks, I'm going to go to court and I'll say what I saw. So what happens to the product of the case? One witness comes and says, I saw this person murder that person. What happens as a result? One witness saw. Nothing happens to the guy. And what about the witness? Well, we didn't believe you, so now you've just besmirched his name on the stand saying he's a murderer. So you've ruined his reputation. So he gets lashes for having caused aspersions on his character, knowing that legally there's nothing we can do about it. So the Gemara responds in innocence, says, hold on, Tuvia Chata, Tuvia is the one who killed Zigud Mangid, and Zigud's going to get hit. So how can it be that these unintentional murders happened by the hands of these people, and the Kohen Gadol is going to die? I don't understand it. Hatam Amri, and some people say elsewhere, Shechem Nasiv and Magbe Gzir, Shechem is the one who wants to marry Dinah, and the whole city has to get a circumcision. Meaning, why are all these people getting punished or consequences for somebody else's decision? It's another way to say, why is the high priest liable for any of this? Amalei Hussab Mepirke, the Rav Shmei, Le Shahelein Levakash Rachman, Adon Levakashim. Again, their responsibility to pray for mercy, and obviously they didn't. Okay, and we're now going to give some anecdote to prove this point, and then we're going to push through three different cases quickly. Ki hadahu gavra da achle ari. There was one case where somebody was consumed, devoured by a lion. Barachot klata parse mine Reb Shu ben Levi. Three parse away from Shu ben Levi, someone was eaten by a lion. Sounds tragic. And what happened? Lo yishra liyo bahadeh tlata yomin. For 3 days, Eliyahu didn't come to Shu ben Levi. Meaning he held him responsible. Reb Shu ben Levi turned around and say, 3 parses away, someone was eaten by a lion. What's that got to do with me? And the Gemara again is suggesting, if something happens within your vicinity, it casts aspersions on your public role. And you could say that it's metaphysical and mystical, and maybe you should have prayed. But if this is being read through the prism of social impact, Reb Shu ben Levi, if something happens in your vicinity, you are not doing your public job. And you might think, well, what can he do to make sure lions don't eat people? You know, that seems like an accident, that you're responsible for public safety. You're responsible for public policy. And if something happens in your vicinity, it is on your shoulders to some extent. Again, he just doesn't get Eliyahu for 3 days. He doesn't get killed or anything. But full stop. So now the Gemara is going to meditate on, are there places where prayers can have an impact or curses can have an impact if they're undeserved? We've now said the Kohen Gadol deserves something, but it's kind of awakened a meditation for the rabbis. Can curses have an impact? If I just walk up to somebody and they deserve nothing and I say, may you fall down a pit, can that have an impact or not? So Amir Amarav says, Kililat Chacham Afilu Bechinam Hiba'a. If a sage issues a curse, it will come to be, even if it's undeserved. So it seems to indicate you should be very careful around sages about tripping up their fury, because if they curse you, even if you don't deserve it, it'll come to be. Minnalan, how do you know this is true? Me Achitofel. So as we're going to go through a case of Achitofel. Anyone familiar with Achitofel? He was an advisor to King David. who eventually at some point switched sides to one of David's sons who rebelled against him. Achitophel is a rare instance where we are given the description of suicide in the biblical text. He hangs himself because people stop heeding his advice. He's a political advisor. People stop listening to him and he feels that he's become useless and he goes to hang himself, which again is a meditation on the perils of government service, the role of self-esteem. This is actually, there's a case of a figure in Dante who ends up in the forest of suicides, who was also a chief of staff to one of the leaders of Florence and ends up being on the out and then feels useless because their whole identity was wrapped up in their public service and they end up killing themselves. And Dante describes it quite sensitively. So here we have Achitophel. What happened? Shebashar shekar David shidin kafa tahoma. David was digging down for the foundations of the temple. He knew he couldn't build the temple, but he was trying to get the foundation started, so he started digging down. And it unleashed a massive flood. He hit like the point where the foundation waters emerged from, and it was spurting up. Ba'al mishve the alma, and it was going to flood the world. This was an unstoppable torrent of water. Everything was going to drown. Amar, he said, maybe I can write God's name on a shard of earthenware and plug up the problem, and the name of God will stop the water from charging out. Can I do that? Can I basically passively erase God's name to save the world? What would you all say?
Yes.
Yes, on what basis?
Sota.
Okay, interesting. So you've presumably heard this case before. There you go. Lake Adam Lamidi, but nobody said anything. David said, hey guys, counselors, can I write God's name even though we'll get erased? Amar, he says, Kola Yodea Davar Zeh, whoever knows the answer, the Enu Omer and doesn't say it, Yechanek Begrono should get strangled on the neck. At which point you go, oh, all right, I guess he's serious. He wants an answer to this. Nase Chitofel Kavachom Abasman, Achitofel made a logical assumption on his own. Amma, he said, just as God says, just to bring peace between husband and wife, you can write my name and then erase it into the water. You can erase my name, which is a biblical prohibition, to save a marriage. Save the world. Of course you can do that. So Amma le Shari, he says, it's permitted. You can write the name. So Katav Shem Achaspa, David wrote the name of God on the shard, Shari at the home, Nachat v'kamaduchte, he threw it down and the water stopped. So what happened? David said, if you don't tell me what to do, you should get strangled by your throat. Achitophel told him, so the curse shouldn't come into effect, because he did tell him. Afilo hachi, even though he told him, k'tiv, what are we told later in the book of Shmuel? V'achitophel ra'a kilona astat sato. He saw that his advice wasn't being heeded. V'yichavoshed achamor, he saddled the donkey, v'yakam v'yelech al beito, he went home, he wrote to his city, v'yitzav al beito, and he commanded his family, meaning he gave his last will and testament, v'yichanek, and he hung himself, he strangled himself. Now, is this because the curses of a sage will always come true, and you're kind of, it's almost a providential metaphysical guarantee? What other possibility is there why this came to be, so to speak? Just because David said it, so it's going to happen? So it's, every case we're going to see, the person who is cursed is there. So it's quite possible the hint is that sages carry weight publicly, again, that you have a huge amount of sway and influence in the public. And if you say something, even if it's undeserved, it'll plant a seed. I'm sure some of you have seen, what's that movie, Leonardo DiCaprio's come up a couple of times today, where they plant a seed in the dream world? Inception, there you go. Can you plant a seed that changes a person's life? That's a long movie, I'll save you time. He says, yes, you can. So here, the assumption might be, that's exactly, David says to Achitophel, if you don't tell me and you know, you should get strangled. And Achitophel thinks, oh, wow. And then he tells him, but that sits with him. A sage said this, and it sits with you, and he ended up killing himself. Rabbi says, chacham afilu al tanai hiba'a. Let's go even further. That a sage's curse, even if it's conditional, meaning even if the person who said it didn't make it extreme and unconditional, it'll come to pass. Minalan, how do we know? Mi Eli, and this is from Eli. Eli was the high priest at one point in Jewish history. Deka amale Eli l'shmol. Shmol was a prophet, and Eli said to Shmol, because Shmol had a prophetic receipt, and he wanted to tell Eli about what was happening, and it was not good news. Eli's house was corrupt. Anyone know what the corruption was in Eli's house? His sons were supervising the temple, and they were corrupt. They were taking bribes. They weren't doing korbanot on time. The rabbinic imagination suggests not only were they not taking korbanot on time, they were abusing women who'd come. It's kind of the picture painted in more recent times of other faiths that can become incredibly corrupt when you've got power over people who are vulnerable and in need of absolution. And that's kind of what was painted in the time of Eli. And Eli says about, he's not really familiar with his own sons. He says to Shmuel, look, I know that there are rumors. Tell me what you know and don't hide anything. I want to know the truth. Says, may God do to you and more if you hide anything from me. Meaning whatever you've been told, if you don't tell me, it should happen to you. But if you tell me, it shouldn't. Even though Shmuel told him everything and didn't hide anything, Shmuel's kids went off the derech too. So again, who's at fault here in the story of Eli?
No one?
Well, his sons go off the derech. According, at least the way the Gemara structure it, whose fault is it that they went off the derech? At some level, it's Eli, because Eli says, may it happen to you if you don't tell me. And Shmuel tells him, and it plants a seed, which again, psychologically, you'd say, so what happens? Shmuel thinks, I'm going to be a bad parent, and becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and his kids walk away, and whatever it is. You could, again, just read it metaphysically. Eli said something, and it triggers something in the cosmos. We can say both Achitophel and in Shmuel, it's actually David who's responsible, and it's Eli who's responsible. The king and the high priest say words so loosely. Whoever knows and doesn't tell me, they should strangle themselves. And Achitophel's dead. Whoever, if you don't tell me everything, it should happen to you. And Shmuel's kids go off the deck. Meaning, if you're in public power, you have to be incredibly careful with your words. And this is meditating on that thing about why is the high priest responsible for these unintentional murders? Because when you're in public office, everything you say is important. And presidents have this all the time. And I say everything they say is paused, and they may think it's not fair. But that's what happens when you're in public office. Every word you say can ripple through. You know, the press corps waiting to catch you on every word, and everybody's listening. And here Achitophel ends up killing himself, possibly because David was too loose with the way he spoke. So over the page. Amar Yehuda Amar Rav, not only does a undeserved curse come to be, not only does a conditional curse come to be. Amar Yehuda Amar Rav, nidui al tanai tzarech hafara. If somebody is banished or put in cherem on condition, meaning you put in cherem if this happens, you still need to end the ban even if the condition isn't met. Again, this is about public policy, being very careful in how it's formulated. How do I know that if you say to somebody, you're going to be in cherem if you say this, and then they don't say it, you still need to get rid of the cherem. How do I know? You heard it from Judah. Dichtiv, as it says, Judah puts himself in cherem. Judah says to Jacob, let me go down and get Shimon back. I'll take Benjamin. And if I don't bring Benjamin back, I'll be a sinner but for the rest of my life, and I won't be welcome. I'll take it on my shoulders. And what happens? He takes Binyamin down, and he sees Binyamin again. So you'd think he's out of the woods. And the assumption of the Gemara is going to be that if you have offered a ban, even if it's conditional, you need to annul it. How do I know? This comes up later. When Moshe is giving his bracha to the end of Dvarim, he says, Yuchi Reuven val yamut, may Reuven live and not die, vazoli Yehuda, and this to Judah. And the Gemara wants to know, what does he mean, this to Judah? Sounds like almost like a question. Vazoli Yehuda, and this to Judah? Kol atan mem shana, the whole 40 years, Shal Yisrael b'midbar, that the Jews were in the desert, atzmatav shel Yehuda ha'megugalin ba'ar, were rolling around in the coffin. They got all the brothers' bones, they were taking them up to Israel, and Judah's bones were rolling around in the coffin, as opposed to being stationary and in place as a skeleton. Ad shamad Moshe stood up v'vikar shalav rachmim and prayed for mercy. Am lefanav, he said to God, Rebon shel olam, master of the cosmos, migram le'yuda le'ruven she'yoda, who convinced Reuven to confess his sin? Yehuda, it was Judah. Vazoli Yehudan, this is what happens to Judah. Meaning, because he said, if I don't bring Binyamin back, I should be a sinner for eternity, he should be in trouble. He fulfilled his word, and it's not fair. Reuven's doing great, and Reuven was saved by Judah, and he's sitting here rolling around. So what happened? Shema Hashem kol Yehuda, God listened to the sound of Judah, al ibri l'shofar, and all the bones went back into the sockets. So his skeleton was put back together. Lokama Alya Leila Matve Durikia, but he still wasn't allowed into the yeshiva upstairs. So his skeleton was together, but his soul was still trapped outside the Eternal Academy. Va'alamotav Yenu, so Moshe continues, bring him to his people, let him into the academy. What is worse than not being allowed into the yeshiva? Being allowed into the yeshiva and not enjoying it, and not knowing what's going on. Lo hava yadik al mishkal mitrach b'shmati bad rabbanan. He said, fine, I finally got into the yeshiva, but this is worse, because I'm sitting here now and I don't know what's going on. I feel out of my element, I can't follow. Yada of Ravlo, so it continues, and God gave him power, so he could engage with the back and forth. Lava yad lefruke kusha, but it still wasn't satisfactory, because he could follow back and forth, but he couldn't solve any of the questions that were being posed. Vazam atzaravtiya, so he gave him assistance against his enemies, so Judah could participate. So that was all, again, a long meditation, that even if you give a ban on condition and the condition isn't met, the ban needs to be annulled. Because Judah said, if I don't bring him back, I should be in trouble. He brought him back, and he ends up in trouble for eternity until Moshe helps him. Full stop, end, the next four lines is a meditation on the final bit of the Mishnah. Ibailahu, they said, hold on a minute, you said, three Kohen Gadol, three kinds of Kohen Gadol, dying lets you go free. Merubah Begadim, Meshuach Melchama, and Meshuach Hashemen. So, B'mitat Kulanu Choseh, Uldim B'mir Echad Mehem. Do they all have to die? Meaning all three, you have to have a Kohen through Merubah Begadim, and Shemen Mishcha, and of Mishcha Tov, they all have to die in order to go free, or just one of them? Tashma, they said, what are you talking about? Nigmar Dinah below Kohen Gadol, Eni Yotzim Mishom Le'olam. We said, if somebody... the verdict is passed, and they don't have a Kohen Gadol, they never go free. So, v'im ita lihada b'rahanach, I mean, it's true that you never go free, if somebody's Kohen Gadol died, then they should go free one or the other one. So, obviously, it has to be all of them, but the leka, now that's talking about, I guess, when there isn't one, full stop, bottom line is teiku, it doesn't really address whether you need all of them to die or just one of them, but if you look at that small little letter, bet, by b'mihtar echad mehem, three lines up from the Mishnah, it tells you that as long as one of these Kohen Gadol passes away, you can go free, full stop, next Mishnah. And this is going to cause some more questions to emerge. Mishenigma Dino, if somebody is in court, for our case, Alec Baldwin's in court next week, let's say the verdict's going to be passed on Wednesday. When did the death take place in his case? A year ago. So that's already happened. Now all we're talking about is the verdict being passed. So Mishenigma Dino, if the verdict is passed next Wednesday, let's say, and say, right, you're going to jail for manslaughter, made Kohen Gadol, and then the Kohen Gadol passes away, Harizeh Nagola, you're done. Your term is up. Meaning 8 to 10 is a finite time. Kohen Gadol dying is as soon as you're pronounced guilty, and they say, oh gosh, I can't believe it, I've got to go into exile. And every time there's a Supreme Court justice put on the Supreme Court, they say, oh, this guy's in his 50s, is he going to be a 30-year influence on the court? Who knows? So you've got a 50-year Kohen Gadol, and you think, I'm going to be in exile for 45 years. And then the Kohen Gadol has a stroke, and that's the end. He didn't even pack his bags yet. Doesn't go to exile. His term is over. His sentence is finished. Im ashlo nigma dino, and if, let's say, Tuesday, before the verdict was passed, the Kohen Gadol passed away, make Kohen Manu achetastav, and then they appointed a new one. So Tuesday, Kohen Gadol dies. Tuesday, a new Kohen Gadol is put on the bench, so to speak. And then they give the verdict on Wednesday. It's all tied to the death of the second guy, which the Gemara is going to say, well, what's he got to do with it? He literally just became God next week. He couldn't have prayed for mercy. I don't understand what his role is got to do with anything. Now, three exceptional cases. Nigma dinner below Kohen Gadol. Let's say the Kohen Gadol died on Tuesday. They didn't replace him yet. The verdict was passed on Wednesday. There's no Kohen Gadol in office when the verdict is passed. For Hori Kohen Gadol, if somebody kills a Kohen Gadol, and they don't appoint a new Kohen Gadol yet. The Kohen Gadol Shaharik, if the Kohen Gadol kills, and they don't appoint a new Kohen Gadol yet, Eno Yotze Misham La'olam, you never, ever, ever get to leave. Your sentence is tied to the death of the Kohen Gadol who was there at the time of the verdict. If there was no Kohen Gadol at the time of the verdict, you never get out. Full stop, next section of the Mishnah. You never go out if you're in exile. You don't leave to testify in a case of mitzvah, which means for the Rosh Chodesh. You never leave to testify in a monetary case. You never testify in a murder case. And even if the whole people needs you, you're Elon Musk. You're the best military intelligence that we have. You never, ever, ever leave. As it says, you shall flee there. Shamte dirato, shemte mitato, shemte vrato. You should live there, die there, and be buried there. Full stop. Third section, last section of this Mishnah. Kashem shed koletet, kach tchuma koletet. Just as the city provides refuge, so too does its boundary. So the suburbs also provide you insulation. Rotseach sheyetzechutz litchum. But if a killer leaves the boundary of the city, umazegol adam, and the Redeemer of the Blood finds you. So here's a question. Let's say somebody, God forbid, killed a family member of mine. I'm the Gaol Adam, and I can... Hillary, I think you're... Hillary, I think you're wanted. Does the Gaol Adam have an obligation to kill the accidental murderer, or just permission? That's the question. You'd imagine the Torah gives you an opening, but it's not going to say you have to kill the guy. But there's a debate here. Second wide line. Rabbi Yossi Glili Omer, Mitzra B'Yagol Adam, Roshus B'Yad Kol Adam. So, well, this is pretty extreme. So if you kill by unintentional, for Rabbi Yossi Glili, anybody at all in the citizenry can kill you. Permitted to. Maybe not ideal, but you're allowed to. But the family has a mitzvah to kill you. Rabbi Akiva says, Rashud b'yad gol adam, no, and this is where the little Zion is telling you, this is how we paskin, that you are permitted to, if you're a family member, v'chol adam chayevin alav, but everybody else is liable for killing them. You're not allowed to just go around killing an accidental, an unintentional murderer, full stop. So let's do a couple lines here, and then we'll wrap up. My Tama. The Gemara says, hold on a minute, talking about the first case. So, the high priest passes away on Tuesday. Your verdict is passed on Wednesday with the new high priest. This Kohen Gadol has been in office for one day. Why is your fate tied to their longevity? They have no... The murder was last year, so none to do with them. Why are they tied to my case? And why should you go free if they die? Uma mishagala kfar yatsa achshav. And this is also... discussing if you haven't even gone to Ir Miklat yet. You're just walking out the court, and then news gets announced, the high priest is dead. And everybody goes, oh no. And he goes, oh yay, I don't have to go to Ir Miklat. Fantastic. Why does that make any sense? Umami shagala kfar yatsa achshav. If somebody who's already in Ir Miklat goes free, mishalo gala in adin shalo yugala. Of course somebody who hasn't gone to Ir Miklat should go free. It's the first kavachoma Abaya makes. For dilmadi gala ichbale, hadla gala lo. But the Gemara responds, hold on a minute, that kavachoma is all backwards. Maybe if you've been to exile, you've had some atonements, and that's why you can go free. And if you haven't, you shouldn't. Midi galus mechaper, the Gemara says, it's not the galus that atones for you, and this is key. Midi kohen gadol mechaper, it is the death of the high priest that atones. And this is where, again, we could meditate for a while, but very briefly. The death of the high priest seems to recalibrate society. It's not just that they are responsible for the culture, but for some reason it dissipates, or seems to dissipate, the anger of the family members. When you get a new administration in, society has a kind of a renewed sense of identity. People shift their attention. Lahavdol, anybody here ever been in Avelus when Yom Tov comes and Yom Tov is cancelled out Avelus? It's a very strange moment where sometimes people get like an hour for Shiva. And then Yom Tov is here and that's the end. How does that make any sense? Rabbi Soloveitchik has a long essay talking about how Jewish law is intended to instruct the emotions. It's not just catering to emotions, it's also trying to instruct them. So during Avelus, it's trying to instruct you through grief. And when it comes to Yom Tov, it's trying to instruct us through community to celebrate, which is meant to overwhelm the grief in some sense. So here there's an assumption that when you've got new administration in, it instructs society to move on. It's a new time, it's a new page. And as a Gaol Adam, you no longer have the right to kill this person. We're in a new world now, and you've got to give the guy a chance. Could be he's going to mess up, and there's going to be more unintentional murders, and then he's going to be liable for that. But once the Kohen Gadol dies, it's a new society.
What's the time when somebody goes ahead and accidentally kills somebody? He has to run to the Ur Miklat. So when they say Nigmar HaDin, this is what, 6 months later, he's in Ur Miklat? Does he come back for the din? What exactly happens?
So he goes to Ur Miklat.
Right.
In our world, these things take time. The way they describe it is that a week later, a few days later, they'd bring him to court, and then they'd adjudicate the case, and then there would be a Gemara
Din. So they'd take him out of the Ir Miklat.
Yeah.
Why can't the guy just kill him while he's out of the Ir Miklat?
So that was a debate about whether they're allowed to kill him on the way, and there's a view that said, you are, but you give him an escort, and they try to dissuade him.
Okay.
And while they're under the escort, the assumption is, he's vulnerable, but we try to do our best to dissuade them.
So he already was in the Iran Mikvah until then he goes back.
Yeah. Correct. And then he goes back if the verdict is passed.
And the verdict is what? That it was accidental.
Correct. Meaning you are guilty of manslaughter. You're not a murderer, but you're a shogeg killer. So you've got to go back. And now if you're told that and the high priest dies, you go free. And then when it says, how could it be? And they give this assumption here that the death of the high priest recalibrates society. Let's do one more piece. Imashla Nigma Dino. What about a case when you reappoint a new high priest? What's he got to do with it? Mane Mili, where does this come from? You are there until the high priest who Hashem Mashachoto, which he anointed with the holy oil, died for him. And this killer anointed him. Why does it use that turn of phrase? It's talking about someone who was anointed during his days, meaning if he was in office when you were given the verdict that you were a manslaughterer, that's who is tied to your case. And this is the important question that gets one-line treatment. Mahavila Mavid, what could this guy have done? Why is he tied to your fate? Meaning, I become high priest on Tuesday. There is a verdict being passed on Wednesday, and he is deemed guilty of manslaughter, so I'm tied to his fate. He's now praying for me to die so he can go free. What have I got to do with him? The murder took place last year. Why should I die as a response for his verdict? And the Gemara says, what was my responsibility as a high priest one day in? What should I have been doing? What could I have done? I could have prayed that he wouldn't get a guilty verdict. That's what I should have done. And I didn't, so I'm responsible. What does the Gemara seem to be suggesting I should have been praying for? Not that the murder didn't happen, but that this guy isn't found guilty. Sounds like the Gemara is saying, I should pray for a miscarriage of justice. Meaning as high priest, I should pray that whatever happened, there should be justice. No, I should pray for him to get off the hook. So this leads to a whole discussion we're going to get into about why this is tied to the verdict, how a high priest might be responsible to hope people get off the hook, even if they did something wrong. Full stop. Amar Abaya. Abai says, we now got some very quick reflections. Naktinam, we learnt from the past. Nigma din vermeit, if somebody had the verdict passed and then they died before they got a chance to go out. And this is now unfortunately happening all the time in Germany in cases where they find ex-Nazis. They're, 96 years old and then they're given the verdict. And people like, they can barely cope outside of the nursing home. You're going to send them away to jail. And this suggests if somebody was found guilty of manslaughter and then they died, so what happens? Malichin atz matav l'sham, you send their bones to the Ir Miklat. That's where they get buried. Dichtiv l'shuv l'shev b'aretz adam ha'kohen, they are going to live in the land until the Kohen Gadol dies. Reiz yushuv b'aretz, what is living in the land? They get buried there. Tana, it was taught, make kodem shemek Kohen Gadol. One's if you die in Ir Miklat before the high priest dies. So you're there, your sentence isn't yet over, and you've passed away. Malichin atz matav l'kivir avotav. Do you eventually get to get buried with your family, or do you have to stay buried in your miklat your whole eternity? It says, it says, if the high priest dies, you get sent back to the land of your inheritance. It says, actually, if the high priest dies, everyone who was buried while they were there gets disinterred and taken to be buried back with their family. And this is an important line in contemporary life, because in Jewish law, we don't disturb the dead. If somebody's buried, they do not get disinterred. And this has impact in forensic cases when they say we want to disinter to test DNA or something, and Jews tend to say don't disturb the dead. Are there any exceptions? One case is if somebody was buried not near their family, are you allowed to disinter them to bury them near their family, even though at some level, we don't believe that makes a difference. Souls are souls, bodies are bodies, but there is a belief in Jewish law that you can disinter to reinter with family, and this is one of the proof texts, that if you died in Ir Miklat, we can disinter you to bury you at home. So that's an exemption as well. Can you be disinterred to be buried in Israel? This happened, I think we mentioned previously, during COVID, sometimes people who had a plot in Israel, they couldn't get there, they were buried here. But it was al tanai, on a condition that they could be reburied at a late. Nigma din v'naseh kohen gadol ben chalutz, and this is an important case. What happens if there's a kohen gadol serving, and then they get disqualified because they're a bad apple? Meaning, it turns out, you were never meant to be a kohen gadol, you weren't qualified for this. Does that mean there was no kohen gadol? So I'm here forever as an exile because there's no one in charge. Lema plug the Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Yeshua. This is an argument between Rabbi Lazar. So Rav Amar Yitzchak Menafcha, Chad Omer Meta Kohuna, V'Chad Omer Bat Lakohuna. One says the priesthood is dead, and the other said it's nullified. We'll stop there. Next time we'll re-explain that and move forward. Next daf we may have to split in half. It may move fast, but it is a very, very text-heavy daf, so we'll have to measure that. But in the meantime, I thank you for your patience. I thank you for your time, attendance. And next time we'll head towards the end of this perek. And in the meantime, we should all have an attentive day without any accidents, full of blessing and no curses.